This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today's date is March 7th, 2007. This interview concerns the ProArte Quartet, and we are privileged to be interviewing Emeritus Professors Rich Bloom and Martha Bloom of the School of Music and, of course, of the ProArte Quartet, with the discussion moderated by Emeritus Professor James F. Crow, major benefactor and fan of the ProArte. So Jim, let me turn it over to you.
I like that, Jim. That's pretty good. I'll live up to this. I thought I'd start off by just the question of how the quartet first came to Madison, and then go back into a little more ancient history of how it got started in Brussels. So maybe the first question is how the quartet came to Madison in the first place. And I know you know about this.
It rested almost entirely, of course, and eventually became more people became responsible for it, but Elizabeth Sprague Coolidge was the person certainly that had the most to do with this scenario, and she was just an amazing woman. She was born, as I recall, the year before Lincoln died, and she was born in New England. But she grew up in Chicago, and the Sprague, she was Elizabeth Sprague, and you may all be familiar with her father's business as the S&W brand. He was a grocer and became a very successful one. And she, as she often pointed out, she was a rich woman, but she did not have a great fortune. She had a substantial fortune, I think is the word she used, which was important. I mean, she just couldn't support everything. Yeah. She had to be very, she was very, very, she was a real Yankee. She watched her pennies very carefully.
And she certainly did get into the act. As
oh, totally. Not only that, she was a musician. She had soloed with the Chicago Symphony. And one doesn't know if her father was one of the major benefactors and whether it was a political thing. Probably it was, but that doesn't mean she wasn't probably a very fine musician. She was very dedicated, totally dedicated to music. And unfortunately, I believe in her late 20s, she suffered deafness. I mean, that was irreversible. And it was not, she was not totally deaf, but certainly that had a lot to do with her interest in music, because she could still respond to music. It was very obvious that she could. And but she, in any kind of a one-on-one situation, she would be all right, but she couldn't, she wasn't even good in that. But she was able to hear in a close situation, but any kind of a noisy room, I think she was completely hopeless and couldn't hear anything.
Did you ever talk with her?
No, no, but I do remember the name, because I grew up, I was fortunate to grow up in Los Angeles at a time when Hollywood was getting so many refugees from Europe during the war, and there was a lot of interest in Hollywood, in classical music at that time, and this concert is sponsored under the AEGIS, A-E-G-I-S, of Elizabeth Sprague Coolidge Foundation, or something to that effect. Oh. And I had no idea what that word meant. I still don't. I have an idea. And that name was on every single chamber music. And my mother was wonderful. She schlepped me to every chamber music concert in the city. There weren't probably that many, but there would be maybe 7 or 8 a year that I would go to. I was, you know, I started studying at 5 and all of that. And it was, I mean, I feel very fortunate, because I heard Kreisler say before he had the accidents, and the famous accident, and he was wonderful. I mean, I was too young to really appreciate it, but at least I have a memory of him.
I heard Kreisler too when I was in about 5th grade or something like that.
Yeah, I think about that age.
And he made a mistake, and I'll never. I mean, he just was. He was playing. This is, you're interviewing me instead of you. and he was playing the old refrain, and he really laid into one chord, and he just squealed. Right? It's the kind of thing that Chrysler's not supposed to do.
Yeah.
Except he had a reputation for making mistakes.
I heard him also. My dad took me to the Opera House in Chicago, and this was after his accident.
Mm-hmm.
And he was playing a recital, and the Opera House is huge, I don't know if you've ever been in it, and here this pianist and violinist way down there, we were up in, and I was, studying and a young student, and I was, awed by hearing Kreisler, And he was playing something by memory he forgot. So he wandered over to the piano and he was playing, looking over the piano's shoulder to, on the piano's
like
music.
Very reasonable
and I thought, well, if he can forget,
that's
so bad that I forget. So, so that's a question.
Well,
you know, Elizabeth Spring Coolidge probably was kept chamber music alive in the 30s.
I'm sure.
I mean,
she
sponsored all kinds of chamber music groups.
Well, she had a rival who, interestingly, was also quite deaf, and that was the widow of the Montana senator, but she, I mean, wait a minute, I don't know if she was his widow. She was the widow of a very rich man.
I think it was a Montana senator, but I can't, what is the name?
And it, but it was a copper fortune, and hers was a very large fortune. I know that they had a friendly rivalry. So, I mean, she, rivalries will keep things going.
Well, we should get back to the
Elizabeth,
coming here.
In her 60s, she was a very dutiful wife, et cetera, and et cetera, as the proper women of those days were. And in her 60s, she lost her parents and her husband, and she decided she needed a cause. And she very... in an organized way, decided that she would do everything she could to bring chamber music to the people. And she was a very smart lady.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't,
I've read stories about these two women who were rivals, in a sense.
Yeah, yeah. I can find them in
that
here.
That they were, I heard once that they sat on opposite sides in the balcony and waved to each other.
Yeah, right, they were. And. Elizabeth Spring had, you know, for her ears, she had one of these big horns that amplified the sound, and she would sit there with her horn. So,
Gertrude Whittall.
Yes.
That's the name.
Isn't it Whittall? Huh?
Yeah.
So, and by the 1930s, she was pretty involved with the Froarty Quartet, was she?
I think her first, it's in here, I think it was like in the early 20s that she first heard them, and it was in Rome, and they were playing a quartet by Casella. And she was involved with the American House in Rome, which supported music. And she decided that maybe these people would, she got to talking to them, and it was, she was quite a romantic lady, and the story was that she perhaps had a crush on Onu. And I kind of understood that. I thought he was a very fascinating person and somebody that she would, that many women would take to. He was very modest.
He was the first violinist in the quartet back in its Brussels days,
right.
And into this country too.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I could fall in love with that picture. He's a very charming guy. And just having read about things that he said in about music and his view of music, I could understand where there was just an immediate meshing of the minds. And so she brought them to America and set up tours. And she had these tours went on both in Europe and America. I know in America she sponsored all of the tours, and they lasted anywhere from 6 to 8 months. They were very long. They were only home for Christmas and maybe a week or two in the summer. And then the rest of the time that they toured Europe, there were not very many professional quartets. Quartets were not considered...
And it was hard to make a living. You had to keep playing. You know, it wasn't like you were sponsored by universities or something like it is now, or other things, recordings or whatever. They had to go out and tour. That was the only way they had to make a living.
That was the only way they could do it.
And you couldn't... You know how that is with orchestras or ballets or operas. You can't just survive by what the audience is bringing in. You have to have some kind of other funds coming in, and that's where she helped out.
Right. She was. So they had a very successful life touring.
So was she the one who sponsored the tour that had them here in Madison?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But she had expressed concern. I think she was becoming less enamored with Onu, not because of any falling out, just because. I think, frankly, she met the Budapest, and I think she liked the cellist or someone to run in the cellist. I think she got a bit of a crush on him. And I'm making it, I don't mean to cheapen it by using that word, but I think it was a not a teenage type thing. But
yes. But
she, by the 30s, or the late 20s, let's see, about the mid-30s, she was wanting to find some kind of a home for them. And I can understand that. She'd been supporting them for 10, 12 years. And she liked Onu, she did not like Prevost or Alou.
Mm-hmm.
And Maz, she never mentions. I don't know. Maz was a bit different than the other three. He was Flemish, the other three were Walloon, and there was, as I found out, quite a clash in that situation. He felt better than the others. I think Prevost particularly was almost a self-taught musician and kind of a, you know, a bull in a china shop type.
A little bit like Bernie.
Yeah.
He
trained Bernie.
Yeah. Alou was Mr. Elegance, and I don't know why she didn't like him, but I think he had a bit of a chip on his shoulder just from reading his letters and so forth. I got that impression. And she was, you know, didn't want to have anything to do with anybody like that. And I think she just thought Prevost was kind of crude. But Onu, the first violinist, was just elegance. The two violinists were both very elegant players. They switched on first violin and second violin, and but as the years went by, she insisted that Onu play first violin, and you know, Alou really didn't have a choice. This was his livelihood, and so he took it in good grace.
I see.
As he was.
It's rather interesting, though, that she would intervene in that detail.
Oh, she everything.
Yeah, but
and
she was a very strong-willed woman.
She also performed with the quartet. And she,
oh, she did?
Yes, and they also performed her compositions. I would love to hear them because, you know, there's a bit of a revival of, I mean, I think of Amy Beach and how lovely some of her works are, and I wonder if Elizabeth Sprague Coolidge was, I have no idea what they were like. They didn't, of course, they never said anything about, that. There's a place here that Squibb. Do you remember seeing this? I think that kind of expresses that to it expresses their feelings toward her.
Let me just interrupt here and for the record say that the booklet that Martha and Jim and Rich are referring to is the 50-year history of the Proarti that was researched and written by Martha. And there is a copy of that history in the paper file that backs up this interview.
Well, I think that I'll try to describe it. It's four staffs, and on one staff is the, and they're like on a score. They're one on top of the other, and it says Proarti, and that's is where the clefs would be, and then they each sign their name on the staff, and what is the translation? Who wants to translate that? That's from the heart or something, for the heart of music.
Not I.
Let's talk about how it got started in Madison.
Well, the reason this is important and that I want to point this out is she was literally looking for a place to a university. She thought the university was the ideal place for such a thing. So she was looking around at different places. There was another place in Washington, and she thought, oh, Washington, the weather is just terrible. You don't want to go to Washington. I mean, not the state of Washington, but Washington, D.C. was a possibility, I know. And I don't think I had that in there. But that she came across the name, and the man that was chairman of the music department here at Wisconsin was Carl Bricken. I don't know where she met him. I never found that out. And she could see that he showed interest in the idea. He was quite an innovator and kind of an interesting guy. And he had, I believe, Gunnar Johansson was already here as kind of an artist in residence. And so she really picked up on that. Yeah. And so their first concert here was in... I think May of 1939,
I think.
Yeah, 39. And, or at least the one in 19...
Had they played the year earlier?
Yes.
Yeah. And then it was in 1940.
It was their second concert that Hitler invaded Norway and then went into Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this dramatic message that Dijkstra, the president of the university, told the audience. And the men didn't know it then. I mean, it had not... I guess it was in the, I don't know if it made the Sunday papers, it was a Sunday morning, and they had an afternoon concert, and it was cold, I remember reading that, and they had a big thing, you remember crazy things, and I remember that the big thing was that should they put parking meters in Madison? That took up all the headlines. So, and then after that, that announcement, which Dykstra apparently felt he had the backing, I don't think that the people here quite knew what to do. I mean, well, what, how do you...
I mean,
you know,
it's a first. It hasn't been done before, so you have to kind of go along and figure out how this is going to work. So,
And he must have just extemporized from the stage.
Yes.
Yeah,
said that
I think
he would,
so.
That he would take responsibility for raising the money and getting the group here.
Was he a known music fan, or...?
Yes, I managed to interview his sister. And she was a neighbor of ours. I think she's since passed away, but she was a neighbor of ours in Colorado, where we have a cabin. And it was kind of interesting. He liked to sing in the shower, and it was not a professional type of music, but he enjoyed music very much. And interestingly, which is just for me, is that he was the provost of the university when I went to UCLA.
Oh.
And so that would have been after his tenure here. I was there from 47 to 51, so he was the provost. And then before that, he was the head of the Department of Water and Power, where my father worked all his life in Los Angeles. And so the name Dykstra had a lot of meaning to me, and I was very surprised to find, I didn't even know he, you know, until I started doing this history, I didn't know that he was here at that time.
You told about getting various people to contribute money.
Yeah.
I saw a letter, and I bet you saw it too, from Steenbach, the vitamin D Steenbach.
Uh-huh.
They asked him if he had supported, and I don't remember the details, but something like this.
I didn't see that letter.
If they played country music, he would support it, but not a string quartet. I think I can find that letter. If I do, I'll show it to you.
That's interesting. Well, fortunately, his widow did support.
She liked music, yes.
Yes, she supported music very generously, classical music.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't know that. I don't think I ever saw that letter. I'm sorry I missed it.
So when the quartet was performing in 1940, this was that part of a series that had started in 39?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, in 39, they did not play all Beethoven. They played, I know they played Death and the Maiden, and that was just part of a series.
Mm-hmm.
And they were extremely well-liked,
mm-hmm.
and as they were just about anywhere, I think. But certainly, this Madison was very warm in their gave them a warm reception. But the next year was also very complicated because they only had three of the regular players, and the fourth player, which was Maz, had stayed between 1939 and 1940. There was the phoning war,
mm-hmm.
and then all of a sudden Hitler went, where did he go first? I can't remember.
Poland.
Mm-hmm.
The Blitzkrieg.
Yeah, but then the phoning war was after that, wasn't it?
Well, after he went into Poland, England and France declared
war. But then nothing happened for about 6 months.
No, and then it was kind of a lull.
And I think Norway was the first.
Okay.
And then within days after Norway, he went into Belgium. And
anyhow, to be clear, that was the very day that the quartet played the concert.
He went into Belgium the very day that the quartet, or I guess it was the day after, but they were just learning about it.
Uh-huh.
So that was a very dramatic moment, certainly for the quartet and for everybody, because, you know.
Tell us about how Maas happened and couldn't get into this country.
Well, Maas developed
actinomycosis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Actinomycosis.
I'm not sure I know my biology.
Yeah, we need you, dear.
We definitely do. And that is where I think it's anyway, at that time, apparently they confused it with hoof and mouth disease, or maybe it is the same thing. I don't know.
No, it's a different thing, but I think they confused it.
They confused it, and they would not allow him, give him a passport to come to the country.
Because that disease, they wouldn't let anybody in. They were so worried about the animal things.
Cattle getting infected,
Yeah. And so they left. The concert was in May, but I'm trying to think when they left. They left several months before that, and they had to find a cellist. Well, guess who just called up, picked up the phone and said, we have a job for you. And it was an Englishman, C. Warwick Evans. And I had remembered him from Hollywood. He was probably playing in the studios in Hollywood at that time. And his wife was a very fine cellist. And I played in a youth symphony in which she soloed. She was quite young. And I do remember because she was very flamboyant. And he was too. And he was the epitome of, oh, I stay there. I mean, he was, and so she, I did read that letter. I had to read it several times because it was just like, you will do this. And he did. And they had just about a week to work together. And that, a little place in the book, I described that as very difficult to work in a new person, particularly a cellist, because the base of the intonation, I mean, the whole intonation is built on the cellos playing, and if a cellos hears things just slightly differently than the other players, and I don't think that Evans had the from what I've heard, Maz, whom I never did hear, would have been a really fantastic cellist, but I don't think Evans was in that.
He had been a quartet member, though.
Yes, he had.
The London Quartet was
right.
Well, I don't know. The London Quartet seemed to form and just band. I tried to find out a little more about that. I was curious as to how much quartet playing he'd done. But yes, he had done quartet playing. And so he came, and they didn't really have much of a choice. They worked. I don't know if they liked him or disliked him. I never really got a clear picture on that. But certainly they were there. So when they decided to come here, they had the problem of getting, they were still trying to bring the Maz to this country. Now, in hindsight and reading a few things, I came to the conclusion that maybe Maz did not really want to come. I don't think he liked America. I mean, the image he had of America. Well, no, he'd been here, of course, touring. And he also never felt like he was one of the others. He was the Flemish person. And in Belgium,
they were Walloons, so
I'm sure that's very real.
Like Northern Ireland and Southern,
in the research I did go to Belgium, and I managed to be fortunate on the train. We had some concerts in Vienna, and we had on the train from Vienna to Belgium, I ran into a gentleman that loved to talk about the problems in Belgium, and this is just one person's view of it, but he said, oh, he said, the country's crazy. He said, what did he call them? He had names for them, but if the Dutch-speaking Belgians get a bridge, then they've got to build a bridge in the French-speaking.
That's right.
And he said, it's just so much taken for granted that he said, you'll find English is spoken everywhere because that way nobody commits themselves to whether they're...
I remember street signs in both different, it's like Montreal, Canada. They have them in French and they have them in English.
But we actually saw billboards in English, and it took me a while. What's going on here? And he told me about that, so I was kind of looking for them, but I had no idea that. So during the years that Priority was forming, this certainly would have been a problem.
I want to interject something because you're talking about going to Brussels, and this is where they started at the conservatory there. So Martha and I went to the conservatory. Thinking, well, you know, this
I
is
took
where
a picture of
the pro
of the
already
door.
Started. You were here. I mean, so absolutely nobody, from the students to the professors, had any idea. Never heard of the pro already. Had no clue what
no
we were term. Talking about.
Really?
Yeah.
Isn't that something?
What year would this?
This
be?
Would be like the Juilliard Quartet
well,
and Juilliard, and they would have.
That was 88. That would have been the fall of 87.
Yeah.
That's and right. I remember going in and I took a picture of the front of the building thinking that would make a nice picture to show the building that they studied it, you know,
yes.
where their
well,
home
they
was.
Formed, you know, like the Juilliard, formed the Juilliard, so.
Yeah.
Now, and then they were the official quartet for the court of Brussels or whatever.
Yeah, right. Well, another patron that they had in Europe was Queen Elizabeth of Belgium, and she was a violinist and a very down-to-earth person and very fond of the people, and so that was definitely... I'm sure there were other ties that they had in Europe, but in fact, there was one year that they did not go to Mills College in the 40s, I guess, because of the New York World's Fair, and they needed the Priority to represent Belgium at the fair in New York, and that would have been, I think...
But otherwise, they had a long-standing relationship with Mills College in the summer.
That would not be the 40s, that would have been the 30s.
Right.
When was that fair? 38?
It was 38 or 39.
Yeah, one of those years, and I just remember that. Yeah, she was very influential in the quartet, and they, Prévost talked about her a lot.
Yeah. Yes, you visited Prévost.
Oh,
didn't
yeah,
you?
We had spent a lot of time with him. He was fascinating. He was very hard to communicate with because he was so deaf, and he was also very blind. Mm-hmm. Not totally blind, I mean, but he needed somebody to help him around. He was how old was he?
I don't know, but anyway, have 90s. You ever seen the
tape that Canadian Broadcasting Company made of us, the Pro Arty, in Vancouver?
I don't think so.
And it, Prevost is involved in the tape.
Oh.
And Harry Adaskin, who was the second violinist in the Canadian quartet that was sort of a rival of the Pro Arty.
Uh-huh.
And there's a picture of them both crossing the Atlantic on an ocean liner, and the eight of them are standing there, two quartets on ocean liner.
That's right, the picture's
it's
in there,
right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Anyway, we were at Harry Adaskin's house, and they set it up so we came in a car, they had the cameras rolling, and it was a rent-a-wreck car. I was the official driver, so, and we get to the door, and we walk out, and the cameras are there, we walk in, and we're greeted by Mr. Adaskin, and Prevost is already there. And we play during the thing, and then Prevost talks during this tape.
Oh,
and have you ever seen this tape?
No, I've never seen that.
I'll see if I can dig it up and let you look at it.
Uh-huh.
You really enjoy it. It's,
yeah.
It's kind of,
might be helpful for this.
It's kind of crude, but fascinating.
Yeah. It would be great to have that for the UW archives.
It's a really nice.
Now, did you arrange yourself so he could hear it? Because was he hard of hearing by that time?
Yeah, but he could still hear. This was a little earlier than
when I wrote about him sitting in the middle.
Yes,
that was like
was
the last year of his life, I think. And that was when he was in San Francisco. But we
this
had
is a
had,
few years earlier.
We had
so.
Had, in fact, you had contact with him long before I did when you were.
Yeah.
And this would have been maybe 5 or 6 years, maybe more, earlier than then.
Mm-hmm. But when the quartet, you know, was invited here. They were supposed to start in the fall. Of course, you come, you know what, and things didn't start quite so early, but you got to be here sometime in September, or maybe August.
Yeah.
And was Onu already ill then?
Well, that's the next story, and it just, you know, there was just so much misfortune aside from the war. First of all, Maz not being able to come, and they tried very hard. They tried to get him on the Trans-Siberian railway, and that to me just seems like, you know, kind of Keystone Cops, but
yeah.
I mean, they actually had people in Washington ready to meet him as he,
but it didn't work, obviously, so.
Yeah.
And he was going to leave from Vladivostok or something like that, and that, of course, was not at all possible. But then the next thing that happened was the quartet spent their summers at Mills College in giving things that are done, just almost every college has something like this now, but there was they gave concerts every week, they had master classes and taught,
mm-hmm.
and had a residency for I think probably 8 weeks there, and they were very popular, and this last one they still had Evans as the cellist because Maz wasn't with them, and Onu was a very, nose to the grindstone person all his life. He wasn't, I don't think he had fun. I don't think that was part of his makeup. He was married and he had a rather, a wife that didn't seem to be able to swing with his, artistic sense at all. He seemed very devoted to her. And they had no children. And she often did accompany. Not for long periods, but the others, the Maz and the Prevost and Alou, all had families with children. And so Onu, also Mrs. Coolidge did not, I mean, she spent more time with him, and every time they'd play a concert and she would be there, which was quite often, I would guess, I don't know what percentage, but I would best guess it was between a fourth and a fifth of the concerts they played. She lived on trains going to these concerts. She would get there and ask him to get there a day early so that they could play sonatas together, just for her pleasure. And they called her the Lady of an Iron Whim.
Wow.
And another violinist called her that, Temianka, and he'd be doing something and he'd get a message that she wanted him to come. This was in Los Angeles, and she spent a lot of time in Los Angeles, and she said, I want you to come and play chamber music, and he had to stop whatever he was doing, and of course, I guess she was just so generous, and nobody wanted to, and they liked her. She was a genuinely likable person, but she was imperious, certainly, or she had an exaggerated sense of entitlement, perhaps, and...
Well, what was it?
This concludes side one of tape one.
This is side two of tape one of the collective interview with Professors Rich and Martha Bloom and Professor Jim Crow.
I should perhaps correct that. I never had the title professor. I was an artist in residence.
Okay.
I don't know if that's important, but...
Yes, let's get it. Let's get your title right.
Get the right title.
Yeah.
This interests me that the place where people could find employment was in Hollywood.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
that's right.
Former quartet players.
Yes.
Yeah. Went there. Evans came from Hollywood, right. Actually, didn't he?
Well, he came from England.
But he went by way of Hollywood.
Yes. Uh-huh. That's where you went, because that's where the money was, and that's where all the jobs were. So every studio had its own orchestra, and good orchestra.
Oh yeah, they were fantastic orchestras. Yeah. And the city orchestras were not that. There were not that many of them. There was San Francisco, Chicago, Boston, Philadelphia, and New York, and I think those were considered the only really prestigious city orchestras. And Los Angeles had one in a class under that, and they were good, but they were not considered the really fine.
That's interesting now, because that's, I think, the highest paid orchestra in the country is Los Angeles. Now. But at that time, the studios were where you made the money. That's where you wanted to work. So.
Yeah.
Of course, that all disappeared. Now it's all just, you know, they hire somebody at a time. They don't have
I feel very fortunate to have grown up in Los Angeles, because it was a place where people, not just musicians, but writers and I suppose scientists too. Mm-hmm. And I was at UCLA for 4 years, and that was great because
Schoenberg
was
there
and Stravinsky.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We had Stravinsky come at least once a year, I think some years more than once, to give master classes.
But Schoenberg was on the staff, right? I mean,
he had been. He wasn't when I was there, but he did come and give master classes and lectures. And so I just feel very, very fortunate that, for instance, this is, you don't want to hear this probably, but I was, the music department, as usual, was housed in the miserable quarters in one small section of the building.
At UCLA.
Yeah, of the education building, but also the art department was in there, and neither the music department or the art department were particularly, you know, they weren't the school's glory, I think.
Football team was the glory.
Yeah, that's about it. And I heard, and I had sung with a chorus. I used to sing in a chorus, a professional chorus, not that I'm a singer, but, you know, being a musician, I got by. And in Los Angeles, and we had done recently a performance of Mahler's Second, which is an absolutely glorious thing. It was my first time to do Mahler, and I was just transported. It was just incredible music to sing and or play or hear anything. And I found out not too long after that Mahler's daughter taught sculpture, and in the room next to the music department, and they needed a model. And boy, did I hightail it over. Now, this I want to add, this was a neck-up model.
I'm glad for that clarification, Mark.
Okay. And so I had, three or four sessions of going and sitting in a chair. And there were only two students, but his daughter also. I did not get to know her. She was very nice, but, I can't say I had any personal.
Was it a Mahler daughter that Berg was so fascinated by?
No. Yes.
The same one, or is it?
No. This, Alma Mahler had two children, and one of them died as very young, five, and Mahler was quite affected by it. This girl was quite a, I guess you'd call her a brat, apparently. I've done a lot of reading on this because I've been fascinated. And she, you know, gave her mother all. Her mother eventually married Franz Werfel, who was at that time a screenwriter in Hollywood. And so she lived and grew up in Hollywood, and she was, you know, one of the bad kids. Went down to the beach, and that was bad. If you were a beach kid,
that's
boy,
right.
You were. And, but she was very nice by that time. Obviously, she was very nice to her students, and I can't tell you any glorious things that happened in the class, but I was just so excited.
Well,
to be sitting there, and I'll never forget that.
Connections are extraordinary.
I know. So anyway, has nothing to do with the program.
But you were talking about Onu then, and the next misfortune of the priority.
Well, Onu was having trouble the year before. He had trouble with his legs, and they thought it was phlebitis or something like that. And he, of course, didn't complain, and he worked, and he went to Mills College, and the others could see that he was not up, he was not performing up to snuff, but he always played all the concerts. And then he wrote to Mrs. Coolidge, and it was, I think, the first time that he had even mentioned anything about his health to her. And at the end, I think he did not play the last concert in
this
Mills.
This is that summer, right?
At Mills College. I don't know when it was, but sometime probably August, late August or so. And she suggested, well, she said, I can get something ready for you in Madison, and you can recuperate in Madison. So he came here a bit early, and it turned out he had leukemia, and it was a fast kind, and he did not last for a month.
And this year would be?
Well, that would have been
40, I
guess. 40 or 41.
40 or 41, yeah.
Yeah, 41.
Now, she brought a doctor to take care of him?
Yeah.
There's some story here.
Yeah, yeah, she did, and she, oh, and Onu, Prevost was so impressed that she took a cab up here from Chicago. She was in Chicago at that time. She didn't know anybody had that much money. Frankly, I don't know anybody today, too. And but she did that, and.
But he never played a concert here. I guess.
No, he didn't. Yeah.
And then he died here in Madison then.
Yeah, and he lived at that beautiful apartment building, the place that she found for him, which is still there. And there's a restaurant in there now. It's next to the Edgewater.
Is it diagonally across from the...
I thought I could picture
it. Yeah, the Kennedy Manor.
Kennedy Manor. He lived there, and his wife, of course, was just devastated. She was there, and she didn't know any English, and she wasn't capable of learning it at this point in her life, and she had TB. Hmm. And so that was a very tragic time.
Are they buried in Madison?
Yes.
Both of them.
In Forest Hills, I guess.
And I think I had submitted a picture of his gravestone, but for some reason... Either they lost it, or I didn't submit it and lost it. But I intended. I had a picture of it.
Mm. And I've seen that picture.
And sometimes I have a friend that lives near there, and we walk, and we like to walk in the cemetery. It's an interesting place. Mm. But I have never been able to find it since then. I had the instructions. You know, you go here, da da dee da dee, and I thought I could find it right away. And I've gone there a couple of times, and I've never been able to find it. But it was a big.
They had to immediately get another violinist, and that.
Well, that was at his I won't say deathbed because he didn't die the next day, but Prevost and Alou discussed it with him, with Bricken, who was the chairman of the music school, and Bricken had a brother who was a violinist, and Bricken wanted this brother to come in. And Prevost had heard him play, and Prevost just said, "No way."
I knew either daughter or granddaughter of Bricken.
Of Bricken.
Named Ann Bricken.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
I did not interview her, but I interviewed her mother, Mrs.
Well,
Dorothy
Ann Bricken stayed in our department one night with a cellist friend that I met at Dartmouth named Greenhouse, who turned out to be a nephew of the famous...
Oh,
Greenhouse.
Oh, right. Okay.
Interesting.
Now, whether they ever were married or not, they got married or not, I don't know. But.
Well, how did they get a hold of Brosa? I mean, what was?
Well, it was pretty contentious, from what I could read.
Was Elizabeth Sprague involved with that too, or?
I think so, but she wasn't going to bow to if the other players didn't want Bricken.
He was a big name. He had sold over the New York Philharmonic, and
the Sunday that they had this meeting at the Kennedy Manor. I had the letter I read it, and I don't think maybe I had a copy of it, where they were all together, and either they had heard it the week before or that day he premiered the Benjamin Britten Violin Concerto, and I guess it was just fantastic.
And they, in those days, you know, Philharmonic was on the Sunday afternoon broadcast.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, if you were listening to the radio in there, they probably heard him play or something.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody listened to that. That was a Sunday afternoon broadcast. And so I think that was just, they didn't know they knew very little about him, except that he'd had a Brosa quartet. And he had studied in Belgium. He was a child prodigy from, Where is the Vigati stuff? I can't think of the name of it.
Spain.
He was a child prodigy, and some people there got together some money and for him to study at the Brussels Conservatory, which was one of the top violin places to go to. And he studied, I think, I don't know if he studied with the same teacher as Onu or not. I don't remember that forever. Maybe I didn't even know. And had played chamber music, so that seemed to be, even though they hadn't met him personally, that seemed to be. And Mrs. Coolidge did her magic and told him, okay, we need you here. He didn't know her. I mean, he probably knew of her. And I think most musicians would do anything to please her because she was such an important person. I mean, she didn't just support the Pro Arti. She had her own quartet, which has squabbled so much they never got off the ground. But she had one for many years. She supported the Coolidge quartet. But not as much as the Pro Arti, and she's just more fond of the Pro Arti.
Now, did she support the Budapest too?
Oh yeah, yes, yeah. When the Budapest appeared, then the Pro Arti kind of went south in her run.
You know, my interest in string quartets, from the standard listen to records at least, starts in 1941, and at that time there were just two quartets.
That's right.
The Pro Arti and the
Budapest. They were the touring quartets. Mm-hmm. That's right, those were the only two that came.
The only other one I remember is the Adolph Busch had a quartet. But that wasn't in the same league as
the Flanzali. That wasn't
But
they never came to Los Angeles. The only two that ever came to Los Angeles were... there wasn't a lot of culture in Los Angeles, but it was inundated with these people from Europe that were in the forefront of Western culture, but the city itself didn't have an apparatus to bring all these people. Yeah. So as far as chamber music, it was, you're right, the Budapest or the Pro Arti.
Now that's interesting, I think, for the record. You know, when you think about today, the Pro Arti then was really something.
And
quite prominent.
Nowadays there's so many quartets, I keep hearing of names that I've never heard of before, and they're good.
And they're very good. But, they're absolutely excellent.
They're all over the place, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But the interesting thing is that after Brosa came, for the next few years, because the war was going on, there was a series of cellos that kept coming and going.
Oh, and the quartet was
drafted. Like a revolving door. Yeah. They keep getting drafted, and they'd have to bring other cellos there.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
What was there four different
cellos? Well, there was Gottlieb. Victor Gottlieb, and there was
Sorkin, which is
it right? Sorkin. Who ended up in a fine arts quartet in Milwaukee.
Sorkin or Sopkin?
Sopkin, I believe it is.
And then the guy, that's the guy from the fine arts, right?
Yeah.
There was another one.
Before Friedlander?
Well, no. It was Evans, Gottlieb, Sopkin, and Friedlander.
In 4 years or something, there was four different cellos.
And it's hard
came
for a quartet to make any, and with a different first violinist. So it was these two hunkering Belgians that really, even those two, they were close, but they were like brothers, but they fought, too, because they had such different personalities. I mean, Onu was such a refined person and very modest, and Prévost was anything but that. It was just the opposite, just the total opposite. But still, at least they had someone. They did have each other, I mean, to some extent. Mm. And Prévost was not able to get his family here. And I never was quite sure if they wanted to come or not. They became involved with the underground in Belgium. Mm. And I mean, it was a safe house for pilots. And he didn't know that until one of the interesting things I read was a letter from a very grateful family in a town right south of London. It's on the train if you go down to where the airport is. And they wrote him a very nice letter about that his wife had shielded their son or kept her at their house and so forth. And I thought that was just a... Prévost, I don't think he ever lied or anything, but you never knew if he was just bragging about things. Yeah. But when I found that letter, you know, that
does that make you really good?
That made me realize, that really was that.
They had also, when Brosa came in, I don't know how much of the quartet meant to him. You know, he was somebody who was a soloist.
He really
came
was
in.
A soloist. I heard him play a solo.
Yeah. And so he formed a trio also with Gunnar.
And Evans.
Yeah, and they played trio concerts along with the quartet sound. There was two different entities going on in
and
the same music school.
And that didn't go over and, well with the Belgian guys.
No, right. So, I mean, that was not, sure that caused waves.
That caused huge waves. And Brosa, after reading, what Onu said and remembering what Prevost had said, I mean, not Onu, Alou, I get those two mixed up, so forgive me. Alou and Prevost often referred to Brosa as an ugly violinist, and and
only in a quartet.
You have to understand musicians. And I read so much of this, and I sort of picked up, okay, I knew Prevost, and I didn't know Alou, but I sort of trusted their judgment. I mean, I'd heard their recordings and so forth. And actually, it wasn't until a couple of years ago that we heard some recordings of Brosa, and he was magnificent.
Yeah, I had... they used to broadcast the quartet. They had a series that went over nationwide.
Really?
I think it was a Sunday morning or something like that.
On the Mutual Network.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh. And it was broadcast all over the country. This was a priority. And I've heard some of those tapes. And Brosa sounds very good.
He was good.
He was a classy violinist. Yeah. But... I don't think he thought much of the rest of the people in the group,
Didn't I hear some point that he wanted to change the name to
Yes, he wanted it to be the Brosa Quartet.
Right.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He didn't suffer for lack of ego.
Well, I had a friend at Dartmouth College who had been in Madison named Kvam. Would you ever have known him?
I don't know that name.
He was a cellist. And he did play once with the Priority. They played the Schubert, two cello number.
Okay.
Anyhow, then he moved to Hanover. But he brought Brosa there to play with the Dartmouth College.
Yeah.
So I heard Brosa then.
Yeah.
I think he was one of those very, very talented people that really was fairly insensitive to other people. And like you say, had an extremely healthy ego. And at first I was very charmed. I read a lot of his letters, and he could write a letter that would just charm an army. And he was, he played tennis and he did all the glamorous type of things. He was very good looking. And I could see, these mousy little Belgians, they were very short people and a little bit on the dumpy side. And
Warwick Evans was a big man, too.
Yeah,
that's right. He was tall.
And so they were not very compatible. And I thought, well, maybe he was a flashy violinist, but crude was the way I kind of took it. But gee, when I heard his playing, it was anything but crude. But he he was not a democratic leader. And I think Onu was.
I see.
And they really had a very wonderful sense of wholeness. Uh-huh. Even with Maz, I think this really did happen. And they were able to sustain it to some extent with Evans. Evans stayed with him for a couple of years because...
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Then when Maz did come back to this country, he joined another quartet, didn't he?
He joined the Paganini Quartet.
That's right, yeah.
Maz did get over here after the war?
After the war,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I believe that he, he toured. That's right, he came here and lived here because of
but
Paganini.
But that was, again, Elizabeth Spring Coolidge.
I don't think so. I think that was Gertrude Woodall.
Was that the other one?
I think
because
that was
somebody,
yeah.
He got somebody to fund a quartet.
Yes.
And so it was a rival quartet then.
This lady had him come and play for her. She wanted to hear some solo music by Martineau. Uh-huh. And he came, at her beck and call, and she was in a Park Avenue mansion. And she was so entranced with him that she said, what would you like? And he said, a quartet of my own. And she said something about, do you want to go back to the Priority? He said, no.
Of course, by then, the Priority wasn't the Priority that he had
there was no
Onu,
and he had certainly had gotten along best with Onu and was probably least like the inner players, inner voices. Mm-hmm. So she funded a quartet, and he chose Temi Anka, who was a marvelous violinist, and I don't know who the other people were, and bought instruments for them, bought four strads for them to play.
Oh my gosh.
No, she had money.
She was.
I would say that's pretty serious money.
Yeah.
Right, although the Strads were not like they are now.
They were expensive.
They've never been cheap. So he came here and had a concert in San Francisco. So much of the Priority history centers around San Francisco, which is kind of interesting. Uh-huh. He went out to at intermission to take a smoke and never came back. He died. He collapsed at intermission.
In the middle of a concert, I mean.
Well, not playing.
But it wasn't playing, but I mean it was the middle of the concert.
Right. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And that was not long after, I think that was maybe their first or second tour.
Yeah. Is Brosnan now?
No, this is Moss.
Moss, of course.
Moss. And I said I had never heard Moss or seen him, but I realized that I did hear the Paganini in their early days, and so I may have, but of course it would have meant nothing to me. That I knew Timmy Anka because he used to give master classes in Los Angeles, and I had been to some of his master classes, and I did not play, and I might assure you, I was just an observer, but he was a very fine fiddle player, and
now,
I knew him, but I didn't know the other people.
Helou got disillusioned somewhere in there when Ryan came. And
after the second cellist or something.
Yeah, I mean, as the cellists were revolving,
yeah,
and the inner voices of the old pro arty sort of were, you know, kind of getting more and more out of the picture, Helou became very disillusioned.
Yeah.
So he went to the studios, right?
He went to Hollywood, too.
He went to Hollywood. And,
yeah.
So he left the pro arty?
He left the pro arty.
Yeah.
And so Prevost was the only, just the only original member that still hung on.
Well, Helou had no ability to sell himself. He just didn't. It wasn't in his nature. And Prevost did. So I think Prevost was a huckster, you know, an entrepreneur as far as his talents, and he seemed to be more, I think he had girlfriends here that he didn't want to leave, and he...
I know one.
We all know one.
Oh, now that's not fair.
This is not for the record. No, I'm not telling.
So what is the year that Prevost ends up being the only original member?
Well, Prevost lasted into 50...
It's when Raye came.
I have it in the pictures, if I can...
But when...
That would be...
46, 47.
Yeah, that would be maybe even 45.
45, more like that.
Yeah,
okay.
Let's see.
That's where Raye came in, so somewhere...
Here's a picture of before with Prevost.
And that's Raye, the second violinist, on the far left.
And that's Helou. I mean, that's not Helou.
That's Raye.
Uh-huh. But you ask about Prevost, and then here's Bernie Malofsky, and that's 47. Uh-huh. So that would have been 46. That uh-huh. Prevost actually stayed through quite a few years with Polish. He and Polish got along very well, interestingly. And although you wouldn't get Polish to admit that later in later years, but certainly that was.
I think when Polish finally came here, he really wanted Moss. Am I right about that?
I think
it would seem logical, but
I think that's true.
I didn't come across that, but I wouldn't think that.
But at that time, Moss was already...
He's already committed to this.
Committed,
to
right.
Playing these Stradivarius instruments.
But it's interesting because, you know, Friedlander had joined the quartet, and he was a Viennese, and so was Rudy, and you'd think this would be something that would be ideal. Now we're getting the Viennese coming in from the Belgians, you know, and the Viennese... But they never got along.
I realized that, yes.
Really?
I understood that they would yell at each other in the middle of a concert. Like, what are you doing there? You know, I mean, why are we doing, you know, what is wrong tempo? You know, I mean, those...
Well, Kolisch was from a very, very wealthy family. His father was a physician, and he was... not just a physician, but he was a physician to royalty. And I got all this from Kunar, and I never knew all of these things. And that his father would do anything to buy him a position anywhere. And he bought him a position at Baden-Baden one summer to conduct an orchestra. And he really didn't have any talent at all. And he wanted to be a conductor, apparently, at that point. This is from Kunar, and of course I'm just taking his word for it. But that was still a side to Kolisch that I didn't know him well at all. You knew him, but just one didn't see.
Yeah. Well, now, he came in 1947, I believe is right, is it?
Sounds right. It was just after the war, because he came over here.
And did he bring Malofsky with him? No, Malofsky came later, didn't he?
Well, Mielewski replaced Prévost.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
When did Rudy? Are you sure it wasn't 46? What does it say in there? When?
Well,
when
it says 40. Broardi from 44 to 47 was Rayet, Friedlander, Prévost, and Kolisch.
Yeah, I think.
So there were 3 years.
I came in 57.
Uh-huh.
Bernie was here 10 years, so he came in
47.
But Kolisch was already here. I think he came in 44 or 45.
Well, not 44 because they overlapped. Oh, okay. This is in 43. Okay, it did come in 44, and Brosa.
Because that's Brosa, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was 44.
Yeah.
And of course, then that was a kind of a completely new makeup for the quartet. When you change
right.
the first violinist like that, the whole demeanor of the quartet
yes.
radically changes.
Yes.
And of course, Kolisch was, into Schoenberg, Webern, Berg, the Viennese school, because he had grown up with these people and pre-read their works and everything like that. So. The repertoire, I'm sure, changed it violently. Kolisch couldn't stand, for instance, Russian music. I mean, just that was the lowest of the trash. You might as well play a pop tune, you know
right.
I mean? So we played no Prokofiev or Shostakovich or
really?
Borodin or anything like that. No, that was
yeah,
that was,
I mean, it
was
just really kind of sad that he was so prejudiced. He just had all of the...
We played German and Austrian composers and maybe French if it was,
no,
you know...
No, I don't
we
think
played
I
the Ravel once.
Oh.
But that was really stretching things to play.
Well, one time, I think it's appropriate here, I found myself with an extra ticket to hear Isaac Stern play. And I ran into Kolisch by pure coincidence
mm-hmm.
and asked him if he'd like to go on that extra ticket. And he said yes, so we went to the concert together. Well, for Kolisch, as you just got through saying, there's just good music and then there's everything else. And Stern played the Bruch G minor concerto.
On a recital.
On a recital with a piano.
Okay.
And Kolisch was absolutely incensed. Of course, he was polite about it, but he said...
not very, probably.
He said the Bruch concerto should never be played, but if it has to be played, let it be with orchestra.
That's all right.
Yeah, he was opinionated.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Put it in one of you about how Kolisch happened to be playing left-handed.
Well, that's very interesting.
Thing.
We don't know.
The story was
we've heard different
that
stories.
We heard from sort of him and everything else that the top of his finger was cut off.
I think the last knuckle was missing.
And that he
oh,
had to
left hand.
Completely change from being this
mm-hmm.
way to this way. And the story we got was went that way until we met his mother once. And somebody in the quartet, either Lowell or me or somebody, said something about, well, how was it that Rudy injured his finger? We heard, and we gave him a couple of stories, and she said, oh, no, don't you remember? You were 7 years old and you got your finger caught in a car door. And that way, we'd never heard that story before. We heard all kinds of other stories, but this was a completely new thing, and that was from his mother. So, it was not that he had, you know, learned to play this way, and then when he was 17 or something, he had to change over.
Thank you.
This was very early in the game,
uh-huh.
and he had been a pianist. The piano was sort of his instrument, but I mean, you have to use all your all 10 fingers on the
yeah.
piano.
Uh-huh.
So that's when he switched over to the violin, and. So it was quite early, either 7 or 8 or something like that. So.
And learned to play left-handed.
And learned to play left-handed.
Backwards.
That's the way he played. And of course, when you do that, the violin has to be completely rearranged because instead of the G string being on the bottom, now the G string goes the other way. So
and also the inside of the instrument is
changed. You have to change the sound post and the bass bar. The whole construction of the violin has to be changed.
The violin is not a symmetric instrument. I mean, it looks symmetric, you
yes.
see this.
Yeah.
But underneath, there's a bass bar on one side and a sound post on another, and the thickness of the top
uh-huh.
is very crucial.
It's different. So there was quite a lot of adjustment that had to be made
yes.
for a violin to
uh-huh.
change.
And it was
over.
Very hard to find a good violin
mm-hmm.
that was...
That would work.
Uh-huh.
That
would
work. I mean,
thing,
Strad
yeah.
didn't
yeah.
make any violins like
uh-huh.
that, so or the major Italian makers didn't do that. But Kolisch was very opinionated, but...
This concludes side 2 of tape 1.
While you're changing the...
because the first...
Just a minute, let me get this. This is tape two, side one, of the ongoing interview with Emeritus Professor Richard Bloom, Emeritus Artist in Residence Martha Bloom, and Emeritus Professor James Crow.
That's clearly Lorna.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Lorna, Rudolf Kulisch's wife, and I became very close because we both played in orchestras in Milwaukee, in an orchestra in Milwaukee and another one in Waukesha, which meant we had about a two-hour trip going and coming many, many nights. And certainly one gets to know, you know, your car mate very well in that situation. But I do have an interesting... tidbit from Lorna growing up in Boston. She lived in Brookline. I think her parents were both psychiatrists, and I don't know if they were Viennese or not. And she would, when she came home from school, she had to walk several blocks further because very close to her house was the Kennedy house, and they were mean. She didn't want it. She said they would chase her and just be not nice people.
Interesting.
I'm sure they all weren't always that way, but she had one doesn't forget those memories as an adult, and I, you know, she may have changed them a little bit, but she didn't seem to differentiate between Jack and his older brother and his younger brothers, mm-hmm. but she just said she always avoided going by the Kennedy house. Mm.
Now, she played some with Kulisch in New York, not as a member of the quartet,
but
with other kinds of support.
Kind of a freelance musician in New York. And Rudy had a hard time of making it for a while. And he was kind of freelancing in New York.
Well, I understood that he was concertmaster of a show orchestra.
I've heard this too,
a music pinnacle. And he hated it, just absolutely abhorred it. And it was looking for anything to get out of that situation, but you know, you have to make a living somehow, and that was an available job.
And she was his standmate.
Yeah, and she was involved with the orchestra.
And I don't know how he played in an orchestra being opposite. That would have been interesting.
Yeah.
Because he used to tell us that there's nothing worse in this world for a musician than playing a rock star. Mm-hmm. He told us that many times.
Well, and Molosky did this too. Of course, that the three of them knew
right.
each other.
Yeah,
one
yeah.
Another. Yeah. And Molosky played in the Radio City Orchestra for a while. And I don't know what else he did. But.
Yeah, that's before he... Yeah.
This is before he came here.
But that last year, when Bernie couldn't play because of his MS, Lorna did most of the playing in the quartet that year.
I see.
And she wanted more than anything to play. She had subbed in the Proarti or in the Kulisch Quartet. Mm-hmm. And I'm not very clear about the history of the Kulisch Quartet because it wasn't that well known. But I'd heard of it. I mean, it wasn't the name that was unknown to me. And... I just don't know that
well,
much.
Well, they did most of their touring in Europe, so that most of their playing was in Europe.
The first Kulisch Quartet, there was an interesting interlude with Elizabeth Sprague Kulisch. She kind of started the Tanglewood thing, and she didn't call it Tanglewood, she called it South Mountain. And I may be wrong, but I have an impression it might be, if not exactly the same thing or the same place, the two were very much connected. And she would have in the summer concerts at her home, her ancestral home in... the Berkshires, I guess that would be in Massachusetts. And she put together an orchestra, and she had an interesting problem of how to seat people. One of the violinists was Onu, and one of, this is back in the 30s, uh-huh. one was Kulisch, and I think it might have been Brosa was the other one, but I don't think so, because they would have known Brosa from that. I don't remember who the third person was. Oh, Ferry Roth, who was actually my teacher for a short time.
Who had a quartet of his own.
Yeah.
I see. Roth.
Oh, yes, he had a good quartet. He was not a good teacher, and I didn't stay with him very long. But and she had a hard time figuring out who to be.
There are eagles involved. I realize that. I'm
becoming very clear.
And I'm embarrassed to say I've forgotten who won that. I left it. It's not in the history. I thought it wasn't really endemic to the... history of the Proarti, so I left it out.
Martha, you were talking off tape that Lorna Kolish was not able to play at the university because there was a rule against it.
There was, and
Jim knows about that too. I mean,
I believe
the nepotism.
It was very real.
Back, right?
And I believe it was actually in writing, but I never knew for sure that that was the case. And a lot of the times, those things can be very strong and not be in writing.
Yeah.
But somehow, I have the feeling that it was in writing, and at some point in the 60s or the 70s, oh, it was the 70s, they, the horn player, John Barrows, met a lady, a single lady at the, he was divorced and maybe in his 50s or 40s when he came here, and he met a lady in the music department, and they hit it off right away, and they wanted to get married, and they were the pioneers in this. Tate Barrows, well, Tate Sanford,
uh-huh.
And then she became Tate Barrows. They got married, and they just...
they weren't about to fire John Barrows.
They weren't.
He was a preeminent horn player in
probably,
the country.
Yeah,
so.
He was a very, very fine horn player, and she was a fine pianist, and there was no reason to fire either of them, and so...
So, yeah, once the thing cracks, why, and then it spreads around.
Right.
And then is now it's... Totally the other way around.
Yeah, yeah.
Hiring both members of a couple.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, they'll go and recruit.
You know,
I mean, if somebody's teaching at one university and the spouse is teaching at another one, they'll say, well, we got a job for both of you here.
Yeah.
Why don't you both come to Wisconsin? So,
yeah.
But
yeah.
I take it that when Lorna Kolish wanted to play, there was
an absolute.
It was
right.
not possible.
So she was just filling in. I think that was the only way that she could get away with that.
Mm-hmm.
And Bernie was still on the faculty. He was still a line item budget.
Mm-hmm.
And he was still being paid a salary. So Lorna was just gratis filling in.
But she had played quartet concerts with
New
York, or at least I don't think it, maybe in Europe, but she had played. Kolish, one of the things we're not talking about is that Kolish was such an advocate of contemporary music. And he was very opinionated, but there was no lacking. I mean, he was very ardent in his desire to push new music. And the fact that something was new meant so much to him. And this kind of set the tone of his approach to everything. I had been performing somewhere in a church in town, Handel's Messiah, and I think that Rich and the other members of the quartet had played a concert, and I'd been playing the Messiah, and when I got there, he asked me what I'd been playing, and I said, the Messiah, and he made a face.
Really?
Well, it wasn't new, and it was popular, and that just did not set well.
See, the other thing is that one of the Bartok quartets was dedicated to Kolish, mm-hmm. Kolish Quartet, okay? But by the time I got in the quartet, Bartok was being played everywhere.
Uh-huh.
So we never played any Bartok. that was already passé.
I see.
I mean, everybody's playing it. We don't do that anymore. So.
But Kolish wasn't the only person in classical music in the late 50s and 60s that adopted this attitude. I think it did irreparable harm to classical music. If the audience liked it, it probably wasn't any good.
That's pretty good. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I mean,
luckily, we've got away from that. But
it's
composers nowadays try to write things that at least people can sort of understand and sit there and listen to and maybe whistle.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's something that it irritated me about Kolish from the beginning, and I didn't have a say in it, so it didn't matter that it irritated me, but it just bugged me that,
mm-hmm.
well, how can this be? I mean, great composers have always, I mean, Beethoven wrote for every level, and Mozart
mm-hmm.
wrote for every level, and they knew they had to, because they were writing for the public.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But that, somehow, that was swallowed up in that kind of attitude, and I think it's one of the reasons classical music has had a hard time making it.
Interesting.
In our life.
Yes, I do.
Now, during the Kolish era, in the late 40s and early 50s, is the Proarti still as prominent nationally as it was in the 30s and early 40s?
Maybe not, but of course, this is an area that we still had those radio broadcasts.
Mm-hmm.
So they were heard nationwide. unfortunately, Rudy was never that gung-ho on touring.
Mm-hmm. So, you did play New York concerts, though.
Yeah, they did play, and they played. They played in the in Washington D.C. at the
Library of Congress.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there was some that, but it wasn't a big touring quartet like you think of the Budapest, who spend most of their life touring. But of course, because you were affiliated with the university, you didn't have to tour that much. You had a basic salary that, and Kolisch was the kind of guy that loved to rehearse. I mean, the rehearsal was better than the concerts. I mean, that was where we worked things out. That was where we really got involved with the music. And by the time we got to the concert,
I think that's very important in this sense.
Yeah, I'll tell you something that obviously wasn't in the book either. Part of our job at the Wisconsin was going out with Arts Outreach and playing concerts throughout the state. That was part of the job. Anything we did outside of Wisconsin was on our own. We booked on our own. We went on a nationwide tour. We booked that ourselves, and whatever money we'd make, which wasn't much, was ours. Mm-hmm. But we were presumed to play at least 10 concerts around the state, either in concert halls, sometimes schools, whatnot. And we'd go out with very esoteric programs. I mean, we'd go to a small town, and we'd be playing Schoenberg and Weber, you know. And of course,
I remember Rudy backstage
looking, pulling a curtain outside, looking at the audience, which are going to be 40 people, and saying, "Fish cadavers." That's what he thought of the audience.
Yeah.
And Martha used to tell me that that's sort of the way he looked when he played, like, that the audience was there, but I mean, that wasn't really part of the thing. He wasn't, he was playing for himself and for the music and not for the audience. He sort of gave that impression. he loved to rehearse, so it's great.
Well, I think I think it's kind of an important thing, because I think his attitude is just plain old adolescent or something at times, mm-hmm. even though he's a very brilliant man. Mm-hmm. But he still attracted people to come and play. Mm-hmm. He attacked you and Lowell, and then he and Bernie and you all adored them.
Well, he had a
and I think it's
mind.
The way he yeah. I think yeah. it's the way he rehearsed and his conception of the music.
Right.
If you
his
could
analytical
get,
conception.
If you could
was.
Get past this kind of adolescent attitude.
Yeah, did you spend a lot of time talking about the music?
Oh, absolutely. Now, here's somebody that played chamber music all his life. That's really what he did, except for that little sojourn in New York when he was playing in the orchestra. But that was small. So he had, the music we were playing, Beethoven or Mozart or whatever it is, he played umpteen times, and here we were two young guys, you know, not that we, Lowell and I didn't have a background in chamber music, but not like that. But we'd get there to start a piece, say we were doing Beethoven, Opus 18, number 3, and we'd start like nobody had ever seen the music before. Mm. And we'd go through it analytically. What happens in the exposition? How is it changed in the development? When we get to the recapitulation, what's different now? I mean, we'd go through it bar by bar. It was like you were in a class, you know. I mean, which was great for Lowell and I. I mean, you know, we were learning the music from a master from the ground up, you know. Unfortunately, that always didn't in the final analysis. Martha always sort of thought things sounded contrived. Like there was not a lot of spontaneity in it.
Intelligent people. Serious music lovers say they really didn't like the concert so much because they were always being not preached or taught, but there was this, I guess, a sense of condescension mm-hmm. that and I've played under other European. I'm just thinking of Otto Werner Mueller, who is the orchestra.
Yeah,
he did
right.
the same thing. Mm-hmm. He. I loved his rehearsals because he would show us how the music was put together, and you just sit down and
that's
it was time to get
said.
Up. You did, it's 2.5 hours, you know? Mm-hmm. And yet the concerts never really took off, and I think there was no, he lacked a sense of meeting. You know, you've got to have a want to communicate what you're saying, mm-hmm. and he didn't have that sense. It was
another thing with Kolisch, he was a terrific violinist. I mean, he got around the violin, and no matter how he was playing, it was pretty well there until very late in his career. But he never had what you'd call a beautiful, lovely
That's
sound.
Right. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Really? His big thing was Mm-hmm. How soft can we play? Mm-hmm. And how loud can we play? I mean, he thought there was only four people in the string quartet, but we've got to expand this range of dynamics. So that was his big thing. Whether it was an ugly, harsh sound, didn't matter to him. I don't know if that was because of all the contemporary music he played or what, but that was very interesting. Also, you have to remember, here's a man that when he had his own quartet, they played lots of pieces by memory.
And, that's right.
Not too many quartets have done that, particularly because the inner voices probably have heart attacks, particularly the violas. Can you imagine?
It's hard to remember something. Right.
Remember, even when I know the piece, I got the music there, I can't always remember what I'm doing. So it's one thing to have the violin part, which is the lead part, and the solo line. I could probably play that better by memory than I could the viola part, because, you know, that's...
Yes.
And the cello part would be the inner voices. I've read some things about, you know, and heard about people going on. They had to push Halu out on the stage sometimes because he didn't want to go out. he said, I don't remember what we're doing in the second movement. I don't want to go out there. So,
Was it Halu?
It was one of the inner voices, either that or Prevost. And I can't imagine Prevost ever.
No, it would have been not Prevost, but it would have been Raye.
No.
That was before.
So, you know, you had to have a certain kind of mind to be able to get whole quartets by memory and go out on the stage and perform them like that.
Well, it was a strange situation.
Say a bit about Coleridge's sense of rhythm.
Well,
metronomy.
You know, he grew up with Webern. And I guess Webern himself had an incredible sense of timing and pacing and... Because you'd play a piece of his that lasted 2 minutes and 15 seconds, and if it was 2 minutes and 17 seconds, he'd say that was too long. It wasn't quite the right tempo. And I think Kolisch got some of that from him. Uh-huh. But Beethoven had metronome marks in his music, at least after the metronome was invented. Mm-hmm. And then he went back and redid some of his earlier works and put metronome marks in. Okay, so a lot of people have discussed this over the years, saying, of course, Beethoven's metronome wasn't right, and it didn't click right, and you know, it was all askew. Kolisch wrote a whole booklet on nothing but Beethoven's metronome markings. And he was absolutely convinced that Beethoven knew exactly what he was doing, that nobody should deviate from this, no matter how ridiculous some of the tempos sounded, that Beethoven knew what he wanted, and this is the way we play it. And that's the way we worked on it. That's the way we played it.
Really?
We stuck to the metronome marks, no matter... through thick and thin, so, which sort of gave you a sense. Also, he loved working with the metronome. Now, a lot of people think if you work with the metronome, you know, you're just getting yourself in a rigid thing, but Kolisch's idea was that if you work with the metronome, then you figure out where you can take time and how much time you can take, rather than just spontaneity, you know, you slow down here and you speed up there. Mm-hmm. He wanted that all planned out. Mm-hmm.
We kept that through. I mean, all the years I was in the quartet, mm-hmm. we did that. And
but that was kind of a holdover from an earlier.
It's just a wonderful way to be comfortable with
it. It gives you a solid feeling about what you're going to be doing, because you got four people and you have to react with them. And if everybody's thinking along the same wavelength, it's much easier to put something together.
Mm-hmm.
Than if you just kind of haphazardly go through it and say, well, I think this tempo sounds pretty good, let's try this. But
Could Kolisch play something at a certain tempo by just knowing the metronome marking? I've heard in rumors that you could say play this at 4/4
and he'd do it. I've heard that same thing. It was never demonstrated to me that he could do that, but I think he probably could.
This is an anecdote, it belongs a little later, but I'll mention it now. This is Malofsky, who was Rich's predecessor.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a novel, and in the novel, the central character is Kolisch. It's a string. It's a novel about a string quartet. Have you ever read it?
No, but I've seen excerpts of it.
It's called Fiddler's Four.
Yeah.
Anyhow, it's a quartet with one man and three women, therefore complicated. And they have all the complications, but the point of interest is that Kolisch, whose character built on Kolisch, is in the hospital, and the nurse comes in to take his pulse,
And he says you don't have to. It's the same as the metronome marking of the second movement of the third Razumov.
Yeah, well, that I can believe. Yeah, I can believe that might even have happened. And Bernie would, of course, know about that. So,
Rich, I want to ask you. You came in 56 or 57.
57.
57. Was Kolisch part of the attraction for you? Did he come after you?
No, in order to get in, I'd have to go back to my earlier career. I mean, I didn't know Kolisch from Adam. Mm-hmm. So, but I grew up in a family that was all violinists or cellists or piano. My brothers played cello in the Chicago Symphony for 52 years. He's still playing there.
Really?
And both of my parents were violinists. My dad was a professional violinist.
Oh.
So we had a string quartet in our family. Mm-hmm. And as I grew up, we played string quartets. And I never went to a summer music camp. We went to Colorado because my dad had TB when he was younger. So the doctors advised him to get out of Chicago. He was a school teacher. Get out of Chicago in the summertime. So we went to Colorado. And we, family quartet, would play quartets. And I started out as second violin, because I was studying violin. And then when I went, my dad was a conductor in a music high school.
Oh.
Like music and art in New York. It was Lane Tech High School, and they had shops, and they had terrific music department. I had counterpoint, orchestration, theory, harmony in high school.
Wow.
So anyway, I was involved with Kennedy music from early days.
Uh-huh.
But, and even when I went to Eastman, I was still quite involved with chamber music there, even though orchestra was the big thing. And then when I went to the San Antonio Symphony, that's where I met Martha. I mean, quartets were always in the back of my mind. Now, I have to go back a little bit. When I was growing up in Chicago, my brother, who was a couple years younger, had a best friend. These were the two hotshot cellists in Chicago, and the other one was Lowell Kreitz.
Oh.
So they were buddies, and they went to rival high schools, but they were, because they were the two best cellists in their age group, they were always coming together, either in orchestras or whatnot. So, and we lived pretty close together, so they were very good friends. Lowell, war was coming on. This is the Korean War. Lowell joined the Navy. He went to Great Lakes in Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
And my brother had went to Eastman, but he was only there for a year, and the draft was coming on. They drafted people in those days. So he left Eastman and went to the Marine Band in Washington. And so did Lowell. Lowell got transferred out of the Navy and went to the Marine Band. So they were both living in the same house in Washington, D.C., and playing in the President's Own, which means they played chamber music in the White House, and that's what they did. I mean, they had to learn how to play the cymbals
they
or something.
They played Hail to the Chief every day.
They were involved in the Harry Truman era, which is a good...
Which was a very good era for the government, for music,
but
and Truman was a...
See, this is a very important, because when my brother got out of the Marine Band, he went right to the Chicago Symphony. That was the Marine Band, the Chicago Symphony. Hmm. Lowell was in one more year. He joined a year later. And when this thing happened with Friedlander, who was the cellist in the quartet, and Kolisch hated him, and they weren't getting along, and he was causing problems in the music school, and they were looking for some kind of excuse to get rid of him. Hmm. And when he was touring in Australia, he wanted to stay over and not come back for a couple weeks. He said, and the university said no. Music school said no, you have to be back when the term starts. Well, he didn't come back. He stayed an extra couple weeks because he had some concert commitments. So they didn't hire him back. They hired Lowell. Kreitz.
Oh.
So Lowell became the cellist in 55. Okay. And then 2 years later, well, 1 year later, Bernie was so sick he couldn't play. And 2 years later, they needed another violist. Bernie couldn't continue. So, obviously, I had known Lowell Kreitz from my brother's being my brother's best friend, and he knew me, he knew my playing.
And he knew I was, at that time I was principal of violas in the Dallas Symphony. And he said, there's a job open in the Pearl Harbor Quartet. We have two or three people that are auditioning, so why don't you come up and audition? And that's why I joined the Pearl Harbor Quartet. So it was a relationship between the cellist who was now there and my brother and Chicago and...
that's interesting.
So that's how that happened.
And you'd never... Had you ever heard the Pearl Harbor
No.
play?
No. Mm-hmm.
And you and Martha are married at this time.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. We married in 54, so this was a couple years later. Yeah.
And I was told when I came here that there
Martha and I were in first stand. Martha was a violist then, so I met her in San Antonio.
And I was told
there
wouldn't be any work for me.
In the viola section, and I saw this lovely young blonde playing behind me in the viola section, and so we got together and married. And then we both moved to Dallas, and we were on the first stand of violas. And that was an interesting year because Walter Hendel was our conductor. And he had kind of a rocky time that year. We had a concert in Fort Worth, and the orchestra went to Fort Worth, and we were on the stage ready to play the concert, and we sat there for a half hour. The audience was there, and no Walter Hendel. Well, he was back in Dallas. He was dead drunk. And they had to cancel the concert, and that was the end of his sojourn. So they were going to have to get a new conductor, and this viola opening came up in the priority. So it was hard for Martha because, you know, now she had been playing professionally, and now suddenly she's in Madison.
Well,
and,
I was pregnant, actually, when by the time we moved here.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And, however, I auditioned for the Lyric Opera.
Oh.
And I got the job.
On viola, that is.
And went to, did play it. It was about a three-month season.
You know, Anne, my wife, told me about going to hear an opera with you in Chicago.
Yeah, we did.
And she said that you told her that you never heard this opera except from the pit.
I know, I've heard very few. I'm not bitter about too much in my life, but one of them is I haven't heard enough operas. And they're just, you have to make a big effort to get there. You know?
There's another person we've got to talk about, but we're running out of time. Your worries about him.
This concludes side one of tape two.